You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The Nature of Evil by Gregory Salmieri.
Listen, what's the most horrible experience you can imagine? To me, it's being left unarmed in a sealed cell with a drooling beast of prey or a maniac who's had some disease that's eaten his brain out. You'd have nothing then but your voice. Your voice and your thought. You'd scream to that creature why it should not touch you. You'd have the most eloquent words, the unanswerable words. You'd become the vessel of absolute truth. And you'd see living eyes watching you, and you'd know that the thing can't hear you. That it can't be reached, not in any way. Yet it's breathing and moving there before you, with a purpose of its own. That's horror. Well, that's what's hanging over the world, prowling somewhere through mankind. That same thing, something closed, mindless, utterly wanton, but something with an aim and a cunning of its own. I don't think I'm a coward, but I'm afraid of it. And that's all I know. Only that it exists. I don't know its purpose. I don't know its nature. That's Stephen Mallory from The Fountainhead, describing evil. Do you sense such a beast hanging over mankind today, prowling amongst us? Perhaps you see it in the demands of the woke cancel culture mobs on Twitter, who try to get fired, shunned anyone whose opinions aren't quite au courant. Perhaps you see it in the people who loot and riot and burn down neighborhoods in what they pretend are protests against racism. Or perhaps you see it in the killings by some police officers captured on video of what seem to be innocent, unarmed people. Maybe you see it in what happened on the Capitol on January 6th. Or in the people who indulge in the mindless, irrational pretenses that have fueled many of the behaviors we've already talked about and that are prolonging the pandemic today. Perhaps you see it in the hysterical responses, the authoritarian measures that have been advocated, adopted, and tolerated to combat the pandemic. Perhaps you see it also in the attacks on our only viable sources of fuel, of energy. I think we all saw it in the attacks of September 11th, 20 years ago, and some of us have seen it in the pusillanimous responses to these attacks by our policymakers that have taken us through 20 years of war in Afghanistan, only to turn the country back over to the same mystic thugs that harbored the people who attacked us to begin with. Are you afraid? Do you feel powerless? Do you think you understand it? A lot of what's so terrifying and so paralyzing about evil is it's hard to make sense of. And so that's what we're going to try to do today. Let's begin with a few observations from Mallory's quote. I take it what Mallory's doing is he's identifying, without being able to understand it, without knowing its essence, something about a kind of behavior, a kind of pattern of action, a kind of way things sometimes go that human beings engage in. He can see the symptoms of something, horrifying, perplexing symptoms, and he doesn't yet know what it is, this something we call evil, this something he calls the gray drooling beast. The thing that's most stressed is its senselessness. It's not rational. It can't respond to reasons. You can give it the most eloquent, unanswerable case why it shouldn't do what it's doing, but you can't reach it. And yet, it's not inanimate like a force of nature. It's not something that happens by chance or by just natural causes. It has a purpose. It has a cunning. There's something like reasoning, like human motivation, and yet something very alien from it. That's what's so puzzling about the evil. It's what makes it so hard to understand. It's what makes it terrifying. And we can see this in the way people in general react to what they regard as evil, in a lot of the common rhetoric about it. You'll notice, if you attend to that rhetoric, if you attend to people talking about evil, discussing it, there's a kind of alternation between viewing it as something monstrous and vanishingly rare, and on the other hand, lightly, trivially, casually diagnosing it in people. It's seen sometimes as hysterical and inappropriate, for example, to compare people to Nazis or Soviets. Why? The Nazis weren't mythical beasts out of, you know, the Bible or some, you know, like J.R.R. Tolkien or J.K. Rowling novel, right? They were real people with real ideas who controlled the country, likewise the Soviets, likewise the Kims in Korea. And yet if you say, you know, that sounds like a Nazi policy or a Soviet policy, it's seen as hysterical, as somehow crazy, as inappropriate, as outside of the bounds of conversation, as though that wasn't something people can do. That wasn't a way people could really be, as though they were some kind of monsters from fiction. Yet, on the other hand, people all the time casually accuse their political opponents of evil, which is maybe what gives rise to the people who react against it. You know, those racist, heartless, etc. Republicans, or those woke, communist, demon rat, Democrat monsters. And so, reacting to this, you have the above-it-all sorts who think this is hysterical, and then who go on to hysterically blame anyone who calls anyone else as evil for being hysterical, crazy, monstrous, irrational. But evil has to be something accessible. It has to be whatever we understand about it. It has to be something that human beings are capable of. Because we see that it happens. These events happen. They come from somewhere. Where does it come from? What is it in human nature? Presumably there's something, some root, something we all have access to that gives rise to the possibility of evil, and that we have to be on guard against in ourselves, in others. We need to understand at least how it could come about such that we don't foster it. There have to be on-ramps to evil, or elements of it, in all of our characters and experiences. But if we're really to understand evil in all its monstrousness, if it's evil that we're going to understand, it also has to be something deeply other than our normal mode of behavior. Something that seems other, alien. Otherwise, it's just, you know, bad, crummy, how things are. So, an account of evil that makes us understand that has to at once make it familiar and alien. And I think that's really perplexing. The closest we come in accounts that we get is the all too common Platonic religious approach, which posits two fundamentally opposed sources of motivation in mankind, body versus soul in Plato's Phaedo, one of them the source of bad, the other of good, and you're good or evil depending on which you side with, nature versus grace in Paul's Christianity, inclination versus respect for the moral law in Kant, egoism versus altruism in Comte. But this makes human nature evil. This makes us evil by nature, and there's something we have to overcome. And that doesn't explain, like, something higher than what we are, evil in ourselves, that we have to aspire to or try to get saved by. But then that doesn't explain the monstrousness of it, the irrationality, the inscrutableness of it, if we're just all sinners, we're all awful. And, you know, some of us are saved or better or have better moments. If we're all constantly fighting against the desire to be something like a Nazi, because we're clearly not all doing that. That's why it seems so strange that something like Nazism should happen. And yet it did happen, and it took over a country. And more than once, things like this have happened. It took over whole periods of history. To me, this is the real problem of evil. That phrase, the problem of evil, is used as a label for an issue in philosophy of religion. How could there be a God if there's evil things? How can you kind of reconcile those two things? And that's worth thinking about in the context of thinking about whether there can be a God, I suppose. But the real problem evil poses to me is how to understand how it's possible and up to us without either trivializing it and making it too venal and like ordinary human motivation. How to capture that it's something different and yet something accessible. That it's something commensurable with ordinary human motivation and yet special, different, and horrifying. and how to do it without damning human nature. It's a problem we need to solve to navigate a world in which there is evil. Evil that can destroy us from without if we become victims of evil people, or from within if we sacrifice our best potentialities to our worst. I think the view of evil I'm presenting in this talk is the one Ayn Rand held, and that what's original to me are just points of organization and exposition. But my aim here isn't scholarly interpretation. I'm going to reference some things by Rand, but I'm not going to attempt to prove to you that what I'm saying is what she held and defend it against alternative interpretations of her someone might have. Nor am I going to try to prove to you that the view of reason I'm going to offer is true. Rather, I'm just presenting a view that I think makes sense of it and that I think is hers. And I'm going to leave it to you to think about whether it makes sense of your experience and whether, again, it makes sense of whether you see it as what she's arguing in her art. Novels. Because of this emphasis, I'm not going to say that much about objectivist writings, not as much as I might. I am going to reference some of Ayn Rand's works quite a bit. But I'm not going to say much about anything else. And since it's a conference honoring Dr. Peikoff and Opar, I want to take a little bit of time from what I'm doing properly here at the near the beginning to just say a word or two about Dr. Peikoff and objectivism, the philosophy of Ayn Rand. This is very much not on the topic of evil for the moment. In his interview with Tal, Dr. Peikoff talked about the project he set for himself when he first met Ayn Rand and that he completed with Opar. What Leonard describes in that first encounter with her is something that I think a lot of intelligent people get from her, though few had the opportunity to get it from her in person, this recognition that she has a whole way of seeing the world that's radically different from anything one's encountered before, and that there's some profound truth in it. Maybe you think the whole thing is profoundly right or just some part of it. There's something really right about this and really different, and it's not a bunch of different things. There's some kind of whole there. And it's hard, I just don't quite see it as a whole. I see the symptoms of it being a whole, but I don't have my finger on it. So much of the intellectual energy around objectivism, at least for the most thoughtful and honest people interested in it, has been expended and had to be expended trying to learn to see this forest through the trees, trying to get one's head around that whole. And that's the kind of work Dr. Peikoff did. It's what he did with Opar, what he presented to us with Opar. Of course, it's still a kind of work, that work of seeing the forest we each need to do for ourselves. But with Opar, he's taken us to a summit from which we can take in that whole much more easily. And here with this talk of summits, the metaphor breaks down because that sounds like there just happened to be a nearby mountain he helped us trek up from which we could look down at the forest. But what he did was he built the mountain, or maybe an observation tower, built painstakingly over 30 years to enable himself to better see the whole and to share it with us. In an earlier panel, I commented on the explosion of quality writing based on objectivism done by a growing number of people over the past 20 years. We're also seeing at this conference signs of other people making powerful use of objectivism to change the world for the better. These things deserve to be celebrated, the individuals doing it, and the institutions such as the Ayn Rand Institute, particularly the OAC and Anthem that are supporting it, and all of you who are donors to many of these enterprises. But behind all of this, and behind many future accomplishments that I expect to celebrate at future conferences, is the fact that there are now three decades of students who have grown up not only with Ayn Rand's empowering philosophy and literature, but with the vantage point on it that Dr. Peikoff has erected. So thank you to Leonard. And with that, I turn from the sacred back to the profane. The essential point here about evil, the essence of the objectivist view, is a point I expect most of you are familiar with. The evil is the irrational, which is destructive, and its root is the act of evasion. Two signal quotes from Ayn Rand. Since reason is man's basic means of survival, that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good. That which negates, opposes, or destroys it is the evil. Man's basic vice, the source of all his evils, is that nameless act which all of you practice but struggle never to admit, the act of blanking out, the willful suspension of one's consciousness, the refusal to think, not blindness, but the refusal to see, not ignorance, but the refusal to know, It is the act of unfocusing your mind and inducing an inner fog to escape the responsibility of judgment on the unstated premise that a thing will not exist if only you refuse to identify it, that A will not be A so long as you do not pronounce the verdict, it is. What more is there to say? Have we done evil justice? Can we go home? I think if we think of, or just, you know, move on to the more celebratory topics of the later afternoon. Well, if we think of this, the act of evasion, the irrational and its destructiveness, as the root of evil, what I want to talk about here now and what I think we need to think about to render evil people, evil movements, evil developments in history, to render them more intelligible and less frightening and more manageable, more dealable with. What I think we need to understand is not only this root, but the tree that this is the root of, and how that tree flows from this root. We need a little bit of an anatomy of it, and that's what I'm trying to do here. Put it another way, what is it that Dagny and Hank don't understand until the end of Atlas Shrugged? Is that they don't understand these quotes, the quote from Galt's speech, for example, that I just read? Probably they don't. It's not something they would have thought to say. But if you said this to Dagny earlier in the novel, she'd have agreed with it. And yet she still wouldn't have done what she did at the end of the novel. She still would have carried on as she was carrying on. If all Galt had to do was give her that paragraph, you know, man, he had a bad strategy, right? So there was something she had to come to see. What is it? It's the tree, what we might call the moral psychology of evil, or the nature of evil motivation. Let me say a few words about where Ayn Rand discusses this, just by way of bibliography. The main place is in the characterization of her villains, especially James Taggart in Atlas Shrugged, and secondarily Lillian in that same novel. There's the chapter four of part three called Anti-Life, which is, I think, the essence of evil, the anti-life, which really delves into Jim's motivation, and in some later chapters where Dagny is coming to understand this motivation better. The best secondary source on this aspect in particular of Rand's writing is a piece by Ankar Gatte in Essays on Ayn Rand's We the Living, about the death premise in We the Living and Atlas Shrugged, and that book is well worth reading for people who haven't, edited by Robert Mayhew, available from the bookstore here, I hope. I mean, it is available from the bookstore, whether we have copies in stock, I don't know. The other places where she discusses it are the penultimate section of Galt's speech, which discusses the motivations of the mystics, the teachers of the false morality that the heroes in Atlas Shrugged are on strike against. And also in several articles about aspects of the culture, where she discusses what she there calls hatred of the good for being the good. And I think the two articles that are the most enlightening sources for this are a very short article called Through Your Most Grievous Fault, where she blames some among her audience for being the murderers of Marilyn Monroe, and The Age of Envy, where she talks about the role of this kind of evil motivation as becoming dominant in our cultures. What are the core ideas that we get in these sources? In Atlas Shrugged, through the characterizations and the discussion in Galt's speech, in The Age of Envy, in Through Your Most Grievous Fault, I think the central idea, and the central idea that Dagny learns, starts the novel not knowing and comes to know at the end, is that evil people don't want to live. They want to destroy. They don't have positive values. In the place of the kinds of values that normally and sensibly and rationally drive human life, they have a kind of lust for destruction. A destruction that's not a means to some other end of a value they want to protect, but that's an end in itself. In particular, they resent reality for posing constraints on them, demands that they have to satisfy before their emotions can get fulfilled. And they resent the people who they see as good because those people stand as a reproach to them. Why can't you be more like them? Why can't you do right like some other men do? And because those people are in fact picking up their slack, carrying the weight that they refuse to carry for themselves, keeping them alive. And that's part of why they stand as a reproach to them. There's a thing as being driven by resentment. Resentment for reality and its absolutism, and a resentment that gets focused on the people who are good, the people who deal with reality, who master it, who are competent, who are moral, the people who you yourself recognize as good. You can come to resent them. And it's that motive, that resentment, that is evil. Ayn Rand calls it hatred of the good for being the good. We can call it nihilism as a kind of motivation. This sort of motivation, though, is essentially different all the way down from being motivated by values. It's a motivation to avoid or destroy rather than to create or pursue. And importantly, it isn't grounded in any underlying motivation to create or preserve a positive. That's what Dagny discovers. You can call people evil, what you can call what evil people act for, values, in the sense that they're goals of the action, and indeed Rand refers to them sometimes as values. She says things like death is the standard of value behind conventional morality, a morality that she thinks is an expression of evil, ultimately. But in the origin of these values or these goals, and in the way they function in a mind, they're different all the way down from real, healthy, life-based values. I think of them as anti-values, on analogy with anti-concepts, anti-ideology, and anti-heroes, three things that Rand discusses. How do these come about? What are they? What's the mechanism? Well, it's evasion. Evasion is the attempt to place a feeling above the law of identity. Specifically, it's the blanking out of a certain thought, a looking away, the refusal to see, not blindness. But where is that coming from? Well, there's an emotion that you want to protect from reality. But the wanting to protect an emotion, a feeling from reality, isn't a sensible, normal, coherent, rational want. What could be protected from reality, and what value could it be? It's, well, as Ayn Rand puts it, or as John Galt puts it, putting an I wish over an it is. But to be is to be something, and a wish outside of the context of a determinate world and a determinate self, where things are what they are, and you are who you are, and there are certain things you need to do to accomplish certain ends. A wish outside of that is a wish to be nothing, and a wish for a nothingness. And the wish to be nothing is the wish not to be. The wish to have the world not be anything in particular is the wish for there not to be a world. You can think of this as a kind of abstract, you know, point, almost quasi-grammatical, and hold it rationalistically like that. But think of it motivationally. Think of it in terms of what it actually means to want not to be what you are, but not to be anything else in particular. All your wants are, you know, you resent the particularity, the identity of things. Well, what is it that you really want? You don't have positive wants. You have aversions. And what you really want is that things not be, that they not be anything in particular, which is not to be at all. Evil ideas, evil doctrines for Rand, and I'm not going to talk about the content of these ideas much here, but just she thinks there are such things, as do I, are in her view rationalizations. They're large-scale rationalizations in the minds of the teachers and promoters of altruism and mysticism of various sorts for their desire for there not to be a world, for their hatred of existence. And in most people, the people who don't promulgate these ideas, who aren't the fountainheads of these ideas, but who accept them and who suffer for it, these ideas are small-scale rationalizations for little, petty, trivial evasions. Not trivial in their ultimate effects, but not something that's coming from I hate reality. Quoting Ayn Rand, there is no honest revolt against reason. And when you accept any part of their creed, your motive is to get away with something your reason would not permit you to attempt. Whenever you committed the evil of refusing to think and to see, of exempting from the absolute of reality some one small wish of yours, whenever you chose to say, let me withdraw from the judgment of reason the cookies I stole, or the existence of God, let me have my one irrational whim and I will be a man of reason about all else, that was the act of subverting your consciousness, the act of corrupting your mind. Skipping a little bit. What you get as a result of this subverting your mind is a censored reality, a splintered reality, where the bits you choose to see are floating among the chasms of those you didn't, held together by that fluid of the mind, which is embalming fluid of the mind, which is an emotion exempted from thought. The links you strive to drown when you evade are causal connections. The enemy you seek to defeat is the law of causality. And this, the attempt to deny the law of causality, leads to the ideal of the teachers, right? The universe of your teachers' desire, the cause of their doctrines, of causeless action, the reason of their revolt against reason, the goal of their morality, their politics, their economics, the ideal they strive for, the reign of the zero. In other words, non-existence, nothingness. So what's the idea here? There are people who are resent reality as such. This is what drives them. They want to destroy, and they have doctrines that they go around the world propounding, which are the voice of this doctrine, the rationalization of this doctrine. But that's not most people. Most people want to exempt from the judgment of reason the cookies they stole, or some other kind of trivial little thing, something they don't want to think about, something they don't want to face. Just this one little thing. We don't have to be a stickler about everything. And it's that that leads them to accept, in one way or another, these kind of doctrines. It's that which empowers them. Again, I'm not talking about the doctrines themselves here, but the kind of idea of subverting reason. The idea of wanting things not to be what they are. They're the people who are driven, their whole life is about wanting the universe not to be what it is. And then there are their enablers, the people who just want these cookies not to be what they were. Or the getting of them not to be a theft when it was. You know, some little thing, minor in the grand scheme of things. But I think there's a kind of synergy between these two types of people and these two types of motivation. The people who are haters of reality and haters of the good for being the good, the evil people, and the action of withdrawing the stealing of the cookies from the realm of judgment. That action is the what evil people do writ trivial, writ small. And it's better people doing that that empowers the evil. So I'm going to talk now about some of her view of the psychology and the destructiveness of the inveterate evaders, of the mystics, of the people who go around the world propounding this kind of ideology, who are driven by a hatred of existence. The clearest manifestation of this attitude, she says, in The Age of Envy, is the attitude of a person who characteristically resents someone's success, happiness, achievement, or good fortune, and experiences pleasure at someone's failure, unhappiness, or misversion. This is pure, non-venal hatred of the good for being the good. The hater has nothing to lose or gain in such instances, no practical value at stake, no existential motive, no knowledge except the fact that a human being has succeeded or failed. The expressions of this response are brief, casual, as a rule involuntary. But if you have seen it, you have seen the face of naked evil. This sounds really accessible to regular people. This sounds like this isn't like just Pol Pot, but like someone you might meet on the street who has this feeling. And when you see it in his brief, casual, you know, slam on Bill Gates or something, you're seeing the face of naked evil in your neighbor, your friend, maybe yourself. In The Age of Envy, Rand distinguishes a range of different feelings that one might have towards a rich man, feelings that might be described as jealousy or envy, but which she wants to distinguish from this feeling of hatred of the good, being the good. She begins with feelings she describes as perfectly innocent, and proceeds through one she describes as increasingly less innocent, until she reaches the apex, the feeling she calls hatred of the good for being the good. These others, she says, are still human beings in various stages of immorality, compared to the inhuman object is, whose feeling is, I hate this man because he is wealthy and I am not. Envy is a part of this creature's feeling, but only the superficial, semi-respectable part. It is like the tip of an iceberg showing nothing worse than ice, but with the submerged part consisting of a compost of rotting living matter. The envy in this case is semi-respectable because it seems to imply a desire for material possessions, which is a human being's desire, But deep down, the creature has no such desire. It does not want to be rich. It wants the human being to be poor. This is particularly clear in the much more virulent cases of hatred, masked as envy, for those who possess personal values or virtues. Hatred of a man or woman because he or she is beautiful or intelligent or successful or honest or happy. In these cases, the creature has no desire and makes no effort to improve its appearance, to develop or use its intelligence, to struggle for success, to practice honesty, to be happy. Nothing can make it happy. It knows that the disfigurement or the mental collapse or the failure or the immorality or the misery of its victim would not endow it with his or her value. It does not desire the value. It desires the value destruction. This is the portrait of the emotion of hatred of the good for being the good. Notice the inhuman, the kind of horror with which she regards this emotion. Right? She describes the thing as a creature that feels this. In Atlas Shrugged, again, she writes, "You who've never grasped the nature of evil, you who describe them, that is, the teachers and preachers of mysticism, as misguided idealists, may the God you invented forgive you. They are the essence of evil, those anti-living objects who seek, by devouring the world, to fill the selfless zero of their soul. It is not your wealth thereafter. Theirs is a conspiracy against the mind, which means a conspiracy against life and man." She speaks of it as a conspiracy without leader or direction, a conspiracy of all those who seek to get away with living rather than to live, to cut just one small corner of reality and are drawn by feeling to all the others who are busy cutting corners, a conspiracy that unites by links of evasion all those who pursue a value, a zero as a value. There are some things about this account of the haters of the good for being the good, of the mystics, of the evil, that might give us pause. First, she's describing a certain class of ideas as evil. And some people think there cannot be evil ideas. Good and evil are attributes of actions, not ideas. And indeed, in Atlas Shrugged, Francisco tells Reardon, "There are no evil ideas, Mr. Reardon, but the refusal to think." So you might be given pause by the idea of an evil idea. Second, she seems to be describing certain emotions or feelings as evil. But sometimes, often, particularly in the context of psychotherapy or self-improvement, we're taught not to think of ideas as things, emotions as things that could be good or evil. After all, you don't have control of your emotions, and morality is about what you have control of. You don't want to castigate yourself, blame yourself for how you feel. You couldn't control that. You acknowledge it and maybe try to change it if you think the feeling doesn't serve you well. That maybe seems odd. It should give us pause. And then finally, you certainly, your therapist will tell you, don't want to think of yourself as subhuman, a creature, because of how you feel. And yet that is how Rand is describing the evil. What to make of this? One thing you might make of it is you might disagree with it. You might think this theory is wrong, self-destructive. I'll talk about some people who think that later, or I'll quote one of them. But I think this theory is right. I think this is a true account of something that happens in human life. Too much, a lot. But then how to integrate it with the facts that really give us pause here, with the truth that is behind what Francisco is saying when he says, there are no evil thoughts, Mr. Reardon, with the advice that therapists may give us, and it's good advice not to denounce ourselves for how we feel, certainly not to think we might be subhuman creatures. Well, I'm going to punt for now on the issue of inherently dishonest ideas by just saying a few things. Dr. Peikoff, of course, discusses this in his essay, Fact and Value. I think it's very clear that Ayn Rand thought there were such ideas. We're given examples of them in Atlas Shrugged right after a whole list of the ideas the mystics hold that are inherently dishonest. There's no conflict with what Francisco says. What Francisco says to Reardon is, there are no evil thoughts, Mr. Reardon, except the refusal to think. But an irrational idea is just a form of the refusal to think. It's just a mechanism of an evasion, a rationalization. Of course, we're not infallible in identifying which ideas are irrational. You could be wrong about that. You can think a certain idea is irrational when it's not. You can even be evasive about it. Maybe there's some idea you don't want to consider despite mounting evidence for it, and so you rationalize away the fact that there is mounting evidence for this idea by saying with some flimsy argument or as pretext that the idea is irrational and it would be wrong to consider it and so forth. So the judgment that an idea is inherently dishonest and can't be rationally maintained isn't a shortcut to dismissing ideas before rationally examining them. And it's not a shortcut to like kind of promiscuous, early, easy, thoughtless evaluation and condemnation of people. It requires work. You have to do mental work, thinking through the idea first to determine that it's false and wrong and destructive. And then, if it's false and wrong and destructive, to think about, well, what causes this? Is it a kind of mistake someone can make honestly, and it's a tricky kind of issue, and this guy didn't come up with the right answer on it, but, you know, lots of people reach this conclusion trying their best, and this is the best they come up with, and so the idea is wrong, but not irrational, not dishonest? Or is it a kind of idea that either in general or in a particular person's case just can't be maintained honestly, so that it's a symptom that the person's lying to themselves? You can be wrong about this second judgment, that the idea is inherently dishonest and can't be maintained honestly, even if you're right about the first judgment, that the idea is wrong. So there's a lot to say about judging of ideas, how you can tell what ideas can be maintained honestly and not. You could ask me more about it in the question period or for examples. But let's just put that issue to the side. I want to talk more about the issue of the emotions, morally judging emotions. We sometimes say that emotions can't be morally judged because they're not up to choice. You don't directly control your feelings in the moment, and that's true. But you also don't directly control your thoughts in the moment in the sense of what thoughts occur to you. You look at something and you wonder why it's the way, and a thought occurs to you and just occurs to you. You didn't like, you know, drag it up. It's just what occurred to you, just like an emotion, the feeling that accompanies that thought may occur to you. Maybe you see someone who's rich, and you think he must have been a crook, and then you hate him for it. But like, why do you think he must have been a crook? Where did that thought come from? You didn't like summon it up or figure it out in the moment. Maybe he is a crook, and there's evidence of it that you're picking up on. Or maybe you're prejudiced against rich people, and that feeling just came up. That thought just came up. What you control isn't what thoughts occur to you in the moment any more than what emotions you feel in the moment. What you control is what you do about them once they occur to you. Do you take an idea that occurs to you as unquestionable simply because it popped into your head? Or do you acknowledge that it's up to you to evaluate it, to see if it's true or false, whether it's supported by the evidence or contradictory of it, before you accept it or act on it? And of course, also, which ideas occur to you now is in part a function of choices like this that you've made in the past. If you're always going on treating everything that occurs to you as an or everything you hear as an unchallengeable absolute, and you just go and act by it without ever thinking it through, more and more dumb things are going to occur to you more and more of the time. And if you spend more and more of your time thinking things through, judging them, how can I tell if that's true? How well do I know this? What's the evidence for it? You're going to train yourself to have more and more, you know, better things occur to you. Well, the same for all of this is true of emotions. You don't control the emotion, but you control what you do about it when you feel it, how you regard it, and the kind of choices you make about this kind of thing and about other things influence what kind of emotions you feel in the future. Any desire, no matter how admirable the desire might otherwise be, how good, innocuous, or even admirable, can become immoral, evil, when one tries to place it above reason, when it's an I wish that one places above an it is. Think of Robert Stadler. A brilliant scientist who wants to do research, has, I think, good reasons for wanting to do research, needs certain kinds of equipment to do that research, rational reasons to want the equipment, but puts that I wish over an it is. Why should these rich people with all their money, these businessmen, have control over what I get to, whether I get a particle accelerator or whatever, just so they could line there, but, you know, and he starts kind of resenting these people, and well, I should just get it if I want it. I want it, it's good that I want it, why can't I have it? Who cares what the cost? Who cares why I want it and how why I want it relates to how I could get it? And so, like, if it's a value, shouldn't there be some way to make money off of it in the long run and I could persuade someone that buying it for me will be a good return on his investment? No, I want it. To hell with reality. Well, even if that value might have started for him in a process that was rational, when you treat it that way, it came into my head, it's my desire, and I just want it, it becomes immoral. And then there are types of feelings types of emotions, like the desire to destroy people you judge to be good, that I think can only arise as the result of a policy of immoral choices over time. Not just, I want it, but if you think about Stadler later, the feeling that Galt needed to be destroyed. I don't think that's something that you could come to experience, and I think people do experience things like that. There are people who just hate Jeff Bezos. Not for any particular thing he did wrong. They might have something they could say about it, you know, and maybe he has some faults that they point to along the way, and maybe they're real faults, but you can tell that's not what's animating them. They just hate the guy. Because he's so rich, because Amazon's so good, because he made all our lives so much better. Where does that come from? Rand views it comes from immoral choices. It comes from evasion over time. It comes from the bad. And it's part of something that's bad that's in you, if you have it. But, I hasten to add, in deference to the sound psychological advice I mentioned earlier, that the experience of such a desire isn't proof that one's irredeemably evil, and for several reasons. First, not irredeemable because we have free will. We can change, we can improve. I'll say something about the scope of it later and about how this relates to the subhuman creatures. But more, it's not proof of evil at all because there are issues of degrees here. There are things that can only have resulted from immoral behavior. But I know of no one who I don't think has ever behaved immorally, who's been perfect, perfectly chosen, perfectly in focus, never evaded anything his whole life, you know, and now he's like, you know, 45 or something and never, you know, had an instant wrong, right? So you can be immoral in any given moment. You have some moments where you're acting well, some where you're acting badly. And occasional immorality can sometimes generate feelings that are out of character, inconsistent, not how you are. This isn't you, but you feel this way in a moment. They cannot be who you are, and they could not be who you want to be. And who you want to be is something you have to earn, being that person who you want to be, by living up to your own standards. That's the virtue of pride. And part of the virtue of pride is acknowledging one's present state, including any warts there may be in one's present state, and working to be what one wants. Holding yourself to the highest ideals, knowing when you're not living up to them, thinking, how can I live up to them better? Or am I right that these are ideals I should live up to? Part of the same virtue. That includes thinking about what one wants in general and in particular moments, about why one wants it, evaluating these moments, motives, and it's by doing this that one changes them. There's a lot to be said about how to do that, how to grow as a person, particularly about how to do it without either beating oneself up for one's own shortcomings or else indulging in one's own whims. Gina Gorland's talk at this conference was, I think, on just this topic and was useful on it. So I recommend that talk with the caveat that I think the little skit with Peter Keating at the end was potentially misleading. But the larger point here is that one shouldn't just be scrutinizing one's emotions like a juror to evaluate oneself. Success in life and in character improvement isn't primarily a matter of working on and redeeming one's flaws, though occasionally one may need to, but of working out what is worth pursuing and how to achieve it. And this is the overarching context for the subject of subjecting one's emotions to reason, of having reason be dominant and one's emotions its assistant, rather than one's reason be the servant, the slave of one's passions. You think about, is this what I really want, taking into account the full context? I mean, I feel like I want this, but is this good for me? Is this what I'm going to go for, taking into account the full context, including all the costs, the means to it, the consequences of it, all entailed by the law of causality? Is this what I'm really going to go for? And if so, then how do I go about getting it? And insofar as one is doing that, insofar as one is being rational in one's value pursuit, insofar as one's working to do that, thinking, you know, well, should I go for this? Do I really want it? How can I tell? Insofar as one is taking what one wants and is paying for it, any emotions that crop up on the sides that might be voices of a worst policy for one's past, from one's past, can usually just be acknowledged and set aside to wither. You often don't have to do anything special to deal with them. Just, you know, say, oh yeah, that's kind of ugly the way I just felt about that guy, but back to life, let me focus on the positive. And those things just kind of disappear. And if one needs to actively work on some of them, the value of doing so has to be understood as arising from the context of one's overall value pursuit, what one's trying to get at life. It won't be a matter then of self-castigation, but of trying to get to where you want to be in life. Still, the recognition that such moralistic self-castigation is wrong and can be self-destructive, and that this is a common error, is one of the things that leads people to deny the reality of evil at all. I think this is true in general, and it's true in people reacting to objectivism, which some people think is too moralistic. It leads them to deny that evil's real, or else to treat it as something so remote from our lives that we don't have to contend with it at all in thinking about ourselves or in those we love. Sure, the Nazis were evil. Sure, some other group was evil, maybe a group that's around the corner but that I don't know anyone in and I don't have to deal with directly other than to try to fight them. Sure, they're evil, but it has no relevance to my own life and to how I have to myself be. It's a trait of those people, of some monstrous other that I can safely and unself-critically hate from a distance, with no implications for any respects in which I may need to improve myself or how I think about myself and my close relations. Or it just doesn't exist at all. This latter idea that it doesn't exist at all, that there is no evil, we can find in a quote from Nathaniel Brandon. This is in a context, and it's a plausible seeming quote, which is why I want to talk about it. It's in a context where he has been criticizing what he sees as Rand's inappropriate moralizing. "We are," he writes, "we are all of us organisms trying to survive. We are all of us organisms trying in our own ways to use our abilities and capacities to satisfy our needs. Sometimes the paths we choose are self-defeating, and sometimes the consequences are disastrous for ourselves and others, but until and unless we are willing to try to understand what people are trying to accomplish, however mistaken their means, and what model of reality they're operating from, such that they don't see themselves as having better alternatives, we cannot assist anyone to reach the moral vision that objectivism holds out as a potentiality, as a possibility for human beings. We are all of us organisms trying to survive. We, as we strap on our suicide vests and walk into the bus and the mall and blow people up, we, as we fly our planes into buildings, we, as we march 6 million people into gas chambers, are all just organisms trying to survive. We, as we hide from our, exempt from our reason, the cookies we stole from the cookie jar, just trying to meet our needs." Bullshit. The whole theme of part three of Atlas Shrugged is that this is wrong. And the novel demonstrates it powerfully. I think the examples I gave demonstrate it powerfully. There's some real difference between this mode of behavior and an organism just trying to survive. Jim isn't trying to live, and neither are any of us in moments of even trivial evasion, even when we attempt to exempt the cookies we stole from the judgment of reason. In that moment, what you're trying to do is not trying to live. You're trying to get away with living, as Ayn Rand puts it in Atlas Shrugged, and that's something very different. Yet, there is a puzzle about how do these things relate, how do we integrate these things? Because all values, all motivation, in some sense, stems from life and presupposes life as an ultimate value. And so there's something confusing about how there can be some other type of motivation, and then there is something frightening about the motivation when we see it in real life. It can be confusing in a sort of technical way if one's thinking about meta-ethics, and people could ask me about the technical sides of the confusion in the Q&A if you want. And it's just confusing and terrifying when one sees it in real life. What the hell is driving this guy strapping on this vest and coming to the mall with his AR-15 pointing at people? What could that be? What could make someone do that? Thus the drooling beast. There's a sort of intention behind it. It's not like this just happens. The sort of aiming and direction, the person straps on the vest, secures the buckles. He went somewhere to get the explosives. It's like intelligent, rational action, but it's not. It's something different. What's going on? Well, immorality is like cancer, and evil is like severe metastatic disease. That's my metaphor for understanding this. Everything in a living being is there in some sense because it serves its life. Its etiology involves the fact that this kind of thing can serve a human life. But they don't, in fact, all serve life, and they aren't, in fact, all aiming at serving life the organism's life, even in the moment. Think about a tumor. What is a tumor? It's a bunch of a person's cells that are multiplying out of control in a way that's going to kill the organism, or could well kill it. And what does it mean to say that they're multiplying out of control, that they're malignant, that they're a threat to its life? It means that the way that they're multiplying, the metabolic processes going on in these cells, are no longer aimed, as most metabolic processes going on in most cells are, at supporting the life of the organism that they're a part of. There's such a thing as mitosis, because mitosis is good for organisms. But it's not good all the time in any situation, and so forth. It's good at the right time in the right way, etc., to paraphrase Aristotle. There are certain conditions under which it's good, and there's a system in an organism that directs its various processes to happen, sometimes and not others, for the sake of the organism's life. And there are some diseases that amount to that system's gotten turned off in some part of the organism. That's what cancer is. The thing that's meant to regulate cell division is just not there. And so the cell division is in the relevant tissue. And so the cell division is not happening in a way that is benefiting the organism or in a way that's in any sense aimed at benefiting the organism. It's happening willy-nilly. In a human being, the thing that directs our other systems, that integrates our many activities, the many things we do consciously and non-consciously in some cases, that can benefit a human life, the thing that organizes them into a self-sustaining life for us, that regulates all our other activities, is reason. And when reason's gone, there's lots of stuff in you that can go haywire. When reason is not running the show, your other systems are no longer directed at life, at happiness, at anything positive. Reason is what would direct them, and it's absent. The master is gone. And just like in the tumor, a system can, without being subordinated to the thing that's meant to direct it towards its proper end, can go haywire and start doing other things. And just like there are predictable, intelligible, well-known, documented by oncologists ways in which this happens, there are predictable, intelligible, documented by philosophers, and to some extent psychologists, ways in which the emotional mechanism gets set in reverse, gets set towards destruction when reason is interacting it. It's reason operating by choice that directs us, that sets our values, that integrates them into a life-sustaining whole. And the emotional mechanism is a faculty that can go haywire when not so directed. Emotions work for us and are only even trying to work for us to satisfy our needs in a context where they're directed by reason. Absent that, they're like the cancer cells out of control, not serving us, not aimed in any way at serving us. Fear, hatred come to rule the day. That's true of immorality generally, not just evil, which I take it to mean severe and full immorality or irrationality. When something's exempt from reason, when reason's not directing it, it's gone wild. And it's run amok. And there are predictable courses of action. It's a matter of psychology and moral psychology to study about how that works. But it eventually basically works by it breeds resentment. Negative emotions, hatred, fear, have a place in life. They're good for us. When properly used, directed at the proper things, they're there to defend values. Values are positive things you're trying to pursue because you've rationally identified them as serving your life. And when you've identified something as a value and you see someone out to destroy it, or some natural thing, there's a hurricane coming and, you know, it'll destroy my, it'll destroy Louisiana, as the case may be. It's right to fear it. And then to take actions because you fear it. It's right to hate certain people because you, or dislike them, but hate them in some cases, because you see them as destructive. But that hatred, that fear is rational insofar as it's subordinated to positive values, and both the positive values and the opposition to the negative threats are directed by reason. You know why, you know what's good and why you want it, and why it's good for you and why you're going for it, and you understand that this thing is a threat to it and the degree to which it's a threat to it, and that's why you hate it and that's why you're opposing it. And you have it all kind of in context and in proportion. That's what healthy negative emotions are like. You can be motivated by fear, sure, but it's a fear of a threat to something you love. It's something you understand is worth loving, and you understand how this thing is a threat to it. And you're not hysterical about it, where the kind of hysteria I mean is that the fears come out of context. It's not tied to the values anymore, and it's not tied to reason, and it's not in any kind of proportion. That is what motivation by fear is, that kind of dislodging, or the kind of immoral type of motivation by fear, the kind of emotionalistic motivation. It's the dislodging of negative motivation, motivation against something, aversive motivation, from the values that justify it and the reasoning that supports those values. It comes kind of untethered. You just fear and hate things. And maybe you have something to say about why you fear and hate them, but it's not really what's running the show. It's like, you know, a cover story. Really, it's just, or, oh. And I wish that wasn't there above it is. A lot of us have that some of the time, occasionally, about something. But if we focus on positive values, we think about why they're valuable, those things can, those other lesser, worse parts of us, worse motives, things that might count as evil if you consider them in isolation, this was an evil thought, an evil motive, aren't the whole picture of us. They're not who we are. They're out of character things. And they atrophy in us, disappear, go away, to the extent that we focus, double down on what we want, what's good, and our reasons for wanting it, and our reasons for opposing the bad insofar as they're things that are threats to the good. All of that could happen even without an explicit work on improving your psychology or so forth, or sometimes you need to work explicitly on improving your psychology. People who experience these kinds of things are not evil, even if they may have or in a given moment act on an evil motive. But the motive, the moment, the thought might be subhuman, a creature's thought rather than a person. But the person having it is a person. That's what it means to say this is out of character for them. But there are people who that's all there is to them. They've been doing this for so long, I think, so much of the time, that aren't positive values left. There's nothing there about other than to destroy. There are certainly literary characters like this. That's what Jim Taggart and Lillian Reardon are. Jim Taggart's not a creature trying to survive. There's no him, there's no self, there's no positive thing other than this kind of motivation that people might experience transiently in their worst moments. But that's all there is to Jim. I think that's all there was to Adolf Hitler. I think that's all there is to a troubling number of politicians. That's what Rand's calling the subhuman, the beast, the anti-rational, the person who's driven by this sort of motive. And is that way not because that's human nature or there's some kind of weird thing that happens where some people are just Voldemort or whatever and come about that way, but because he's doubled down on the worst in him year after year, choice after choice, moment after moment, and come to a point where it's too late, and that's all there's left to him. He didn't have to be that way. We don't have to be that way. We don't have to tolerate that kind of motivation in others, and we don't have to tolerate even the little bits of it we might find in ourselves sometimes. And it doesn't have to be some great project of psychotherapy, although, you know, some people need a great project of psychotherapy, but it doesn't even need to be some great self-reflective project to focus on values, to focus on one's life, to focus on one's reasons for wanting what one wants, rather than to let oneself fester in the type of motivation that's characteristic of the creature. So I want to close by talking about some symptoms of anti-valuing. And anti-value is, again, this kind of value that is the whole story for someone like Jim Taggart. It's how he rolls. It's what makes him tick. But it's also there, you know, a little bit in most people some of the time. And what it looks like, what it feels like, at least this is now my own sense of it, and what to do about it. Because typically these things aren't pure. Typically it's not that you're like Jim Taggart or someone that's with respect to some aspect of his life and totally like John Galt with another. Even on a given issue, you'll often find that your motives are mixed on something. In The Age of Envy, Ayn Rand talks about how difficult it is to tell when someone's motivated by envy, because most people, most good people, are mixed. And so you find Bill Gates, and there are some bad things about him and some really good things about him, and somebody hates Bill Gates, and it's hard to tell. Does he hate him because of the bad things or the good things? And maybe there's not an answer to that. Maybe it's not that this guy hates Bill Gates because of what's good about him, and this other guy hates Bill Gates because of what's bad about him. Maybe this guy is you, and maybe it's Bill Gates or someone else, Mark Zuckerberg. And maybe, like, part of what's going on in you is you recognize some really bad things about him, but maybe you're, like, over-focusing on those more than you should, more than is justified by the reality of it or what you know about it, because there's something else niggling at you that you don't want to name. It's real, your acknowledgement and knowledge of his faults, but there's more to the picture than that. And the other part, the leftover, is some resentment you feel towards him. Easy to hide from yourself, easy not to see. Well, I think you should look for cases where you or someone else is always drawn to the negative, where that seems to be what animates them. They can talk about, you know, issues. Think about Jim Taggart. He's, you know, having sex with Betty Pope and so forth, and maybe they'll go out to dinner, and the guy's just like a schlump. He doesn't care. He's not animated, and nothing excites him. And then he thinks about this meeting today where he's going to get to put the skids under his sister, and all of a sudden he comes alive. There's an electricity to it. That happens. You sometimes feel people sometimes feel like motivated by negative things, not by positive things. Maybe even people who aren't altogether awful. Maybe even people who are pretty good. But in some issue, you notice, like, I get excited by, like, someone's downfall. Maybe I get really excited when I hear something bad about Trump or about Biden, or I get to put a dig in at one of them, you know, whichever one I hate most, right? Real things to dislike about them. I can't tell you how bad I think these guys are. And Trump in particular, I think, is essentially morally like Jim Taggart. But do you get, whatever you think, whichever guy you think is worse than whatever politicians or, you know, people you know, are you, like, really fired up by now I can, like, put the screws into this guy, now I can really hate on him? Or, and, like, you don't get excited like that in this realm, say in politics, about things that are good? That's suspicious. Maybe you need to refocus. Are you more excited by the bad than the good? Has your feelings about the bad in general or in some realm, your fears, your anger, your frustration, come unmoored for the positives? Or when you tell yourself, like, why do I hate this thing, this guy? Why do I fear this thing? Does the answer you give yourself really account for the intensity of it? Or is there some residual, some extra? Where's that extra from? Maybe you should deprioritize that thing a little bit until, like, the amount in which you're acting on it is consummate with the reasons you have for acting on it. Maybe you should think about, well, what are the positives? If I'm so upset at this thing, this guy, this policy, this whatever, and my reason is that it threatens this other thing, all right, am I doing the things to promote that other thing? Or do I only get interested in this when I can, like, tear down the thing that's a threat? If I'm, like, really for free speech, I tell myself I'm really for free speech, and that's why I hate so-and-so who's against free speech or a threat to it in some way. All right, I'm doing something against so-and-so. What am I doing for free speech? If I'm not doing anything for free speech and not motivated to, except to bitch about the people who I think are against it, maybe what's driving me here isn't that I love free speech. Or not all the way. And maybe I should do more to promote my values. After all, morality is a guide to values, not a guide to putting things down. I'm giving a talk on evil, but I'm telling us don't just get away from evil. The way you do that is to get towards the good. Another symptom, I think, of disvalues playing too large a role in your thinking, another symptom of anti-valuing, is seeing yourself as a victim and being very attached to your view of how you're being victimized. Now, here too, we have to be careful, because if you really are a victim of something, it's important to know it and not to sanction your victimization. And it's important to acknowledge that, and if you think, oh, I got this, there's nothing wrong, this person hasn't mistreated me, that can lead to a lot of bad. And indeed, the plot of Atlas Shrugged, right, is about people who are victims recognizing it and refusing to sanction it. But people sometimes think of themselves as victims essentially. They go through the world and they're always everything's someone else's fault. It's, you know, the patriarchy or white privilege or the liberal media or and all these, you know, some of these things are real, some of them are imaginary. But I'm talking about the kind of person who, like, whatever is wrong with their life, someone else is to blame for it. They're not doing anything about it. They're miserable and they could tell you why everyone else is at fault and not them. Or in some area, like they're interested in politics, and all they can tell you is about what's wrong with politics and how, well, you know, there's no chance and everything's bad and there's nothing we can do about it, and it's these guys and those guys, and if only they were out of the way. But no positive alternative. This kind of victim-passive mindset. That's, you know, Jim Taggart, my sister. You should see my sister in Francisco and what they did. They always think they're so good. There's this kind of resentment victimology mindset that I think is characteristic of passive thinking, of anti-valuing, of not focusing on your values. And I think everyone experiences this sometimes. Everyone sometimes needs to give themselves a little kick to get out of this. Well, what can I do about it? You know. And so, a thought on what's involved in isolating the evil. And that's really the conclusion here. What is the solution to evil? The solution is to isolate it. The evil is the irrational. It's the anti-living, the out of control, the non-directed at the deepest level. And qua the irrational, it's weak. It's destructive, sure, primarily destructive of itself. It destroys other things in the context, but you can usually, often, to a large extent, get away from it. It draws its strength from the good, whether from the better elements in the same person who tolerates it within himself, or from others who tolerate him. Often tolerate him because there's some cookies they stole, and they'd want to exempt that from reason. So notice it. Don't make it an edifice. Don't, like, ruminate on it, and all you're doing is picking up the evil. But just notice, I am attuned to values, and this is something different than that. This feeling I had, this thing I was thinking of doing, what he seems to have done there, this is not that. This is not value pursuit. This is not trying to make the most of one's life. And isolate it. Don't regard anti-value motivation, whether in oneself or in another, as something one has to accept, as something one has to think is okay, as something one has to deal with. And one way in which we too often accept it is by treating it as inevitable and fearing it exaggeratedly, and so refusing to look at it and name it, whether in oneself or in someone else. So my aim here was to try to make it more intelligible what it is, so that one can look at it, one can name it, one can say, what's going on here is some feelings become unmoored from reason. And so in some area, at some time, some person, me, someone else, is being motivated by anti-values, not by values, by fear and anger, and by the satisfaction of or removal of fear and anger, rather than by anything that they might be trying to achieve. That's what's going on. That's it. That's what's happening here. That's not inevitable. That person can do better. If it's me, I could do better. That's the thing that, when writ large in the world and in a person, is a horror. When writ small, it's petty and pathetic. I don't want it as part of me. It doesn't mean I won't have anything to do with myself if I've been this way, and I'll be depressed and mope forever. It doesn't mean that I'll ostracize or castigate anyone who I've seen any of this in. But it is not what I'm in this for. It's not what I'm in life for. It's not what I'm in this relationship for. It's not what I'm going to promote, praise, or deal with in people. I'll deal with in them what I see as good. Deal with them around their values, not around their fears of disvalues. And in my own life, I'll focus on what matters to me, on why it matters to me, on how I can achieve it, including how I can remove whatever obstacles there may be to my achieving it, or avoid those obstacles, rather than on fury and terror at the bad in the world. I know what it is. I got it. I can avoid it insofar as it's possible. And there's a lot of room to make for myself a fantastic life. Thank you.
We have about 20 minutes for questions. I think we'll go to Nikos first for one online.
Well, this is always frightening, Nikos. You appear like Big Brother. You're giant, like a gray, drooling beast up there.
Indeed.
All right.
So here is the question that got the most votes. Who is worse, the conscious ideologue, Ellsworth Tuohy, who has a plan to unleash evil to the world, or James Taggart, the drifter, who ends up effectively a killer?
It's hard to compare those two because they're across different novels and there's a little bit of a different view of human nature. But I think the closest equivalent of Ellsworth Tuohy and Atlas Shrugged is Floyd Ferris. And so the question is, who's worse, Floyd Ferris or Jim Taggart? I don't know. Ayn Rand sometimes says things like, if there are degrees of evil, then the most evil man is, so forth. But I take seriously the question. I think once you're that bad, you're all the way bad. And you know, there are other dimensions along which we might contrast you, but I find it hard to say. They're just so horrible. Both of them are people you've got to make sure you've got nothing to do with, and should give no sanction to, no, you get the hell away from, go on strike against. All the way, anyone who's a Jim Taggart or a Floyd Ferris or an Ellsworth Tuohy. And that's the kind of value of judging people. I think assessments of degrees are if you have to decide, well, I'm going to, you know, I'll hire this person part-time but not full-time, or I'll be friends with them but won't get married to them, or they're okay to buy groceries from but not to, you know, like they've got something wrong in them but they're not people I've got to say I've got to keep all the way away from. When someone's all the way evil, maybe there's a way to make, you know, distinctions of degrees among them, but I think really at that point in making decisions about them, you're just thinking strategically. Both these guys are all the way evil. Which one's going to draw his gun on me quicker or whatever so that I have to duck? But it's not an endorsement of either. And so that's how I'd think about, you know, I don't know if you could say Jim or Floyd Ferris is more evil. I'm not sure if I... she said different things that you can draw out what you would think of it, but even she seemed to express some tentativeness on it. But I think that the value of these, of thinking in terms of these degrees sort of gets exhausted once you get to that level. If there's some difference, it's not a difference that matters that much. What matters is you gotta not deal with any of them, either of them at all. And if you find yourself in a situation where you're forced to choose to deal with one of them or another in some situation, you're not going to make the choice by working out which one's better. You're going to make the choice by working out which one's a bigger threat right now. Like one of them's got a gun and the other's only got a knife.
My question is actually related to that. Over the years, I've heard many discussions of, oh, you're worse than so-and-so because you knew what he did and you didn't say anything. Or you're worse than so-and-so because you knew what he did and you didn't stand up and fight physically, or because you're smarter. I have no objection to judging levels of moral breach and irrationality, but as you said, In the case of evil, would you acknowledge a legal but not a moral distinction? For example, Stalin versus Walter Duranty. Stalin, the mass murderer, Walter Duranty, a so-called journalist who covered up and lied about him. I would think that Stalin, it would be great for him to be executed, not necessarily with a trial. I don't think Walter Duranty merits the death penalty. I wouldn't help him if he were lying in the street, but that's different.
My mic's not up. There we go. I agree that there are issues of moral versus legal culpability. There's someone who's a criminal who has violated rights and therefore should be dealt with by force by a government. And there are people who have done things that are evil, maybe more evil, in what motivates them and in what they've done than violating anybody's rights directly. And I think Duranty, the apologist for Stalin, is about as bad a case of that as you can get, but who the nature of their evil hasn't been a rights violation, and so it's not the right thing to do to deal with them by means of government. You should deal with them by not reading Duranty, by telling everybody how, I mean, not reading him in a way that helps him. You should read him as a study of his evil, by telling people how bad he was and so forth, by not supporting him. You should deal with a criminal by arresting him, etc. Stalin is neither of those things, right, because he's not somebody who we're in the same political system with, so he's not rearrested. We should, you know, like, either bomb him, blow him up, drop a bomb on him, or cut off his, you know, so we're not in the same country with him, so we're not in a legal system with him. But, yeah, he's to be dealt with by force, and he's an initiator of force. Force isn't the only or even always the worst kind of evil, but it's the only one that ought to be dealt with by force. It's a special kind of evil.
But you're saying there is some sense, some usefulness in comparing Stalin's evil and Duranty's.
I mean, there's different things one should do about them, but I don't know. I mean, they're both awful. They're both bad enough that I don't know, you know, unless you're the god in, you know, the kind of Dante's god, and you've got to figure out what rung of hell to put the person in. Mm-hmm. I think, like, once the answer is go to hell, that's enough, and we don't need, you're not sorting the levels, you know.
Thank you.
I think the issue of degrees is where the person shouldn't be condemned to hell, but you should say, you know, that was really bad, but not that bad that I should have nothing to do with you, but I'm not going to shop at your store anymore or whatever. It's where there's still some good left that the issue of degrees, I think, matters more.
Thank you.
And I'm not saying you can't make the judgment. It doesn't seem to me to matter that much, and I'm not sure how to do it.
Hello. Great talk. So one question I had was, one of the powers of objectivism is how it allows you to have an integrated perspective. And oftentimes when a young person encounters such a philosophy, and when I say one, I mean even partly myself, you suddenly have the ability to analyze cultural trends or historic trends and have a broad perspective and make powerful commentary about it. And it feels empowering. And one of the things that happens is concrete things become a trigger to make broad cultural commentary. And it almost seems like an inability, like having an integrated philosophy which does not allow you to enjoy your moment, like to see every concrete as, oh my God, look at this good thing and look at how this good is not everywhere or how it's going away. My question is, with regard to trying to resolve this issue about, you know, being able to enjoy your life, your moment by moment life, and also have a philosophy that, you know, gives you an integrated perspective, should you stop yourself? What should you do if you see such a tendency in yourself?
Well, why don't you use philosophy to integrate about the good things as well as about the bad? So what you're describing is a person who's existing in a industrial society made possible by the continual work of virtuous geniuses, both in the past who found the things, who started science, who came up with the principle of individual rights, who came up with how to make a highway and how to make the internet and Amazon and all these other things. And then using the internet and the books you get from Amazon and Power and Light and so forth, you're learning about all the bad stuff people are doing, which is really bad and can threaten to undermine it. But you're like really integrated to that when somebody, you see the recycle bin or whatever around the corner, you think, well, recycling's really wasteful and we're being forced to do it, and think about all the force, and you're really seeing this little thing, this one recycle bin, and this is Kant, damn it, in the light of things. But
exactly.
You're not seeing that, like, yeah, but here's Aristotle keeping you alive, here's Ayn Rand, here's all the people who are little fragments of John Galt, who are every day all over the world and for centuries have been holding you aloft. And you're noticing the people who are biting at their feet, trying to bring them down, who need to be noticed, but not in a context where you're not saying, this is awesome, there's these atlases here. If you see the rodents and not the atlases, then you're integrating only in looking at the negatives, not the positives too, and you need to do both. So Leonard Peikoff talks about Ayn Rand having assigned him to do walks sometimes. And one of them was a causality walk. If you're having trouble like thinking about the idea of causality and what it means in your life, go outside and look at all the things you see causing things. And it's a way to kind of, do a virtue walk. Go out and think about, like, this stop sign, is here and I didn't crash. And, why is that? Someone thought this intersection's, a problem. They figured out that someone figured out that a stop sign is having it bright red is a way to see it. And every little thing, someone did. Everything that's good, someone made, and someone's still working to sustain. And that's inspiring. I'll give you one other, more concrete exercise. So when my wife and I got married, we needed, it's a convention to have little, kind of party favor things at the tables. And so I came up with one that I really enjoyed working on, which was what I called approbation cards. And so we just thought about all the things we liked, like TV shows, certain foods, particular products, Glean fluorescing protein and CRISPR and all these. It was before CRISPR. But all these kinds of things, before we knew about it, I knew about it. And just look up for each one of them. Pick big life-changing ones and little ones, like baguettes or whatever. And just look into who created this thing? Who are the people behind it? And we made a little card for each of them and put them at the table. And it was a way to show, here are values. And values come from people, and people are awesome. And this is, they're awesome when they're living as people, which very few people do full time. It's a shame that they don't. But the ones who do are fantastic, awesome. And a lot of people do a lot of great by living as people part time. So there's that. Also, if you want to inculcate this perspective in younger people, read a little bit about Montessori and the perspective she took on the great men of history who invented everything.
Thank you.
We have another online question from Nikos.
Nikos, you're silent, which makes you more ominous. He's not there. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. We have evolved in such a way, asks a friend, that reason is man's means of a survival, but also with the potential for evil motivation. But if there really is the potential for the anti-life in human nature and human biology, then why hasn't evolution selected against it?
Well, it hasn't selected against cancer either, which was my analog for it. Right, every kind of system has failure modes, has problems it can encounter. The whole cellular metabolic apparatus, that's part of how all of us and all the other, eukaryotes, I guess, live on a metabolic, at the kind of most, micro level. That whole system is susceptible to certain ways of going wrong, and it does go wrong, and people die. Everyone, really, has died, except us, and we're all gonna. So, life has got a 100% fatality rate because it goes wrong. It doesn't last forever. And the way we survive is by reason, and reason to, cell division and DNA replication and all these other things has a particular way that it works. It has a particular nature, and its particular nature involves operating by choice. Maybe there could be something that was like reason that didn't operate by choice that some, you know, other creature could have. I don't know. But what we have isn't that. It does operate by choice. Maybe there couldn't be anything like reason that didn't. I don't know. But what we have operates by choice. And so when you have a directing mechanism that operates by choice, when you have values that are formed by choice, inherent in that is the possibility of defaults on those choices, of making the wrong choices, of just deactivating or turning off your mind, and then of the bad things that can happen as a result of it, the moral analogs to cancer, and thus of evil.
So in the context of the impotence of evil, we often talk about the innocent sanction of the true victim. Do you think there's more to be said about like what might be called the semipotence of the small-scale evader who is created, it can create to some degree, but to the extent of their evasion, not just their innocent sanction, they're okay. Supporting and enabling the evil?
So there's the idea that there's the evil guy and then the innocent guy who empowers the evil guy by sanctioning him. Mm-hmm. And does it through total honesty. He just doesn't realize what's happening. Right? It's not some kind of immorality on his part that's causing him to sanction the evil guy. He's just oblivious. He doesn't understand. He's doing his best. Maybe this is Reardon across Atlas Shrugged, mm-hmm. or Dagny. And you're saying, isn't there a case where there's like the semi-good guy who's like good in some areas and bad in others? And yeah, I think that's true. I think the way I think about that is that you have that same dynamic between Dagny and Jim or Reardon and Lillian happening within people. You have your Reardon-like elements, and maybe you have some Jim-like elements in certain areas, or a certain person does. And you have that same issue within you. And not like by nature, not like you've got Jim on one shoulder and John Galt on the other, and it's like we're all this way by nature, and we've got to struggle between them. But maybe you just have some motives that are coming out of, you know, a different kind of psychology, different kinds of psychologies, different kinds of choices you've made. Well, then you have a choice. Which do you side with? Who am I? Am I going to be which of these guys do I want to be? Do I want to be the Jim Taggart-like guy, or do I want to be the John Galt-like guy? If I can see the difference between these two types of motivation, which do I want to go with? And I think just getting to the point where you can do that makes a huge difference. Maybe you're someone who's, for whatever reason, plagued with these recurrent Jim Taggart thoughts and you can't shake them, and like you've got to find a method to get rid of them. But very often, if you can just notice, ooh, that's kind of ugly, I don't want to be that guy, I want to be that guy. Not like I want to repress or pretend that I didn't have the thought of the one guy or the feeling of the one guy for a moment, but just like I have an option now. Am I going to support what I love or just, you know, rage against what I hate? Which am I going to do today?
Thank you.
You got that choice. And making the right choice amounts to going on strike against whatever element of bad there might be in you.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one last question. It'll be live, but that's it.
Okay. I was hoping you could say something about ideas as evil, particularly if whether or not you can judge an idea is evil, but separate that from the person and say, okay, this person has evil ideas, but they're essentially, you know, a good person?
Yeah, I think you can. So what is it for an idea to be evil? It's for it to be two things, and I think those two things come together. It's not such that you could rationally maintain it. Not such that you can rationally, thoughtfully maintain it over time. Maybe it could occur to you and you haven't thought about it much and you heard it and just assumed, but like if you're actually trying to live by it and think about it and notice what happened, you can't rationally maintain it. You have to be evading to maintain it because the evidence flies in the face of it. And two, and these things always go together, it's destructive. If you try to live by this thing, it's going to wreak havoc, which havoc you ought to notice and therefore kind of reconsider, which is part of why you can't rationally maintain it. And it's evil for both reasons. It's irrational and it's destructive. And again, those go together. The irrational is destructive. So that's what it is for an idea to be dishonest. It's not an idea that can be honestly maintained, and in that sense, it's an evil and so destructive idea. Can someone hold such an idea without being a bad person? Well, two respects in which I think yes. One, they might not have held it for very long or very thoughtfully. They've just encountered this idea that, you know, give them a week or a month or a year and they'll see what's wrong with it. If they go their whole life with this idea, you know, then I think no. And then how peripheral is it to who they are and what they do? Is this somebody who is not very interested in politics, let's say? The ideas he holds in politics, and that'll espouse if you ask him, are really awful. But, you know, he doesn't give them any thought. He's not particularly motivated by them. They're just, you know, when he thinks about politics, this is what comes up. But that's a very small part of his life. He thinks of it as a very small part of his life. He's just not about that. The more that's the case, the more the idea is isolated, small, in a peripheral area of his life, the longer he could go, honestly, and not see what's wrong with it, and not suffer the full effects of it, and not cause many effects on other people of it, because he's just not using it that much. It's kind of, you know, out there. And also, if it does require some dishonesty of him to maintain it, the less dishonesty it requires, right? So, you know, maybe this is an idea that even this kind of guy couldn't hold without evading. But he's got to evade, you know, once every 6 months for a half hour or something, versus the person, you know, Stalin or who's got to be evading everything he does every hour of every day, or Jim Taggart. So I think, you know, how peripheral is it to the person's life matters.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.